This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Rebecca Hill about her recent book, Men, Mobs, and Law.
This book is an amazing and remarkable analysis of leftist protest campaigns, from John Brown to George Jackson.
We discuss the case against Royal Dutch Shell in the United States.
For over a decade, human rights lawyers have tried to get Shell into court for torture, killing, and other allegations of abuse against the Ogoni people in Nigeria. Finally, the court date has come.
Stay with us.
Heidi Boghossian, it's nice to see you.
Michael Smith, welcome back from literally down under.
I was halfway around the world.
In Australia.
I was in Sydney. Then I went to Melbourne, where I visited the owner of Ocean Press, who's publishing the new book that Michael Ratner and I are coming out with, Che Guevara and the CIA. It's the story about how Che was tracked by the CIA for most of his adult life, and eventually the CIA helped corner him and execute him.
And has the book been written?
We have pretty much the manuscript. We've got to turn the whole thing in on June 30th. So
excellent.
When I leave the station, I'm going back to do some more homework.
Might be a premium down the road on one of our fundraisers.
We'll get it out to all of you out there in radio land. Australia was really quite amazing.
Did you see any kangaroos?
I saw 16 kangaroos on the fairway of a golf course. I saw two kangaroos grazing on the lawn of some guy's home. My wife saw one hopping through the forest, the bush, they call it, when we were driving along. They're all over the place, like deer in North America. And we saw also flocks of wild parrots. The sulfur-crested cockatoos, those gorgeous white birds with a little yellow plume on their head, are wild down there. And they're considered pests because they eat the mortar out from between the bricks, and the farmers shoot
them. Like our pigeons.
Yeah, like pigeons. They cost $3,000 in a pet store here, and there were pests there. So nature was fabulous. Art was great. Museums, the Aboriginal art. Food is a gourmet place. I recommend it if you can get there. I mean, it was like 22 hours on an airplane.
Not nonstop.
Well, we stopped off in L.A., but coming back, we flew straight through. You know, you're in a daze for the next 2 weeks. I'm partially in a daze now.
Well, it's so great to have you back, and we have a few updates for our listeners.
Well, you know, you told me about that Harris County, Texas story, and I thought it was significant because it really is indicative of problems nationwide with criminal defense attorneys.
This is a county in Texas, and we already know that Texas has one of the hugest records of executing individuals. This county apparently has court-appointed attorneys who take on really more than they should. And as a result, there were something like 6 individuals who were executed because their lawyers missed the deadlines.
Yeah, oops.
Oops.
Well, get a load of the caseload that these lawyers have. This is what a lawyer is allowed to handle every year. 150 felonies, 400 misdemeanors, 200 juvenile cases, 200 mental commitment cases, and 25 appeals. That's like a joke.
That is
And that's why they fall asleep at counsel table in the middle of a trial, and that's why they miss deadlines, and that's why justice in Texas and in a lot of other places is a joke.
We wanted to draw listeners' attention to Michael Ratner's recent article on his blog, justleft.org. And in this article, he talks about his disappointment with the Obama administration's change in direction regarding preventive detentions, essentially.
Yeah. Well, Holder, his attorney general, said they're rethinking the question. And he says it essentially said that if they can get away with it and the world thinks it's fair, they want to keep about 100 people in preventive detention. That is, holding them without charges, without trial, possibly forever. Maybe not in Guantanamo if they eventually close it, but then here in this country. And Michael wrote quite eloquently about preventive detention. And then also, Heidi, the second part of his article, justleft.org is Michael's blog. The second part of the article is about military commissions.
Michael mentions that according to some of the lawyers in the administration, the reason they want to revive military commissions is because apparently in regular courts, and Michael says that is some reason, prosecutors want to use hearsay evidence and inmates may have been brutalized, but essentially Michael is saying these trials would be an abomination, and we, of course, agree with that.
225 years of trials in federal courts in this country. Why do you need a special kind of, well, obviously why you need it, because you get convictions. You make up stuff after the fact, like rules. You can use hearsay evidence, which goes unchallenged. You can't cross-examine hearsay evidence, and use evidence derived from torture, which they've admitted. Read the blog, justleft.org. Men, Mobs, and Law is the title of Rebecca Hill's new book that explores the complexities of protest movements, race, class, and gender. Author Rebecca Hill draws comparisons in two types of left protest campaigns, those that defend labor organizers from prosecution and the anti-lynching groups that seek to memorialize lynching victims. Hill says that both groups have influenced each other throughout history and specifically connects the narratives and stories of the NAACP's anti-lynching work to the IWW's labor defense campaigns. Rebecca Hill's treatment of these dramatic stories has been called fresh, lively, richly detailed, and impassioned. We're delighted to have Rebecca Hill with us here today.
Rebecca, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Rebecca has this fabulous book, as we've talked about, Men, Mobs, and Law. And we'll have you talk a bit about it, but I guess the thing that was intriguing to me right off, and I have a very superficial view of it, was how you compared the anti-lynching movement, or the movement essentially to get laws enforced to stop lynching, against labor movements and others that tried to say the law is actually oppressive. So in the movement, whether it's John Brown, International Labor Defense, whatever, saying they're oppressive, and the sort of contradiction that I actually have in my own life, because now, like for Guantanamo people, I'm saying enforce the law, give them their rights, and yet, of course, when we defend people, we're saying the law is oppressive. So I think that's at least a central contradiction I think you're trying to address in the book.
Yeah, that is something that I discovered in the process of doing the research on the book. And I hadn't, you know, when I first started the book, it was about martyrdom in the American left and heroic politics, like the politics of heroism. And I thought, oh, I'll take these particular cases, John Brown, the Haymarket, et cetera. And I was working on the Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner case, who are not in this book, but I wrote about in my dissertation, and realized that there was this whole other problem that people were dealing with, which was exactly what you're saying, right? That there is no law enforcement, and that the source of terror that black activists were dealing with was extra legal. And that their whole history of anti-lynching activism, once I sort of started in the 60s with the civil rights movement and then went back and started looking at Ida B. Wells and Du Bois and the history of anti-lynching organizing, that they are dealing with the problem of mobs that were acting in a way that, you know, was chaotic and crazy and terroristic, and that their whole aim was to get the federal government more involved, while the socialist left was celebrating to an extent, right, sort of in at least in literature, you know, kind of chaotic uprising, uncontrolled upsurges based on emotion, passion, and feeling. And that this actually was going on at this very same time, so that you have the Haymarket anarchists during their defense, and then after they're executed, their supporters are saying that the grief of the mourners is going to come like tears into the grave, and it's going to raise the spirit of revolution, and there's going to be this mass upsurge of passion. And that's in 1887 through the 1890s. At that very same moment, you have Ida B. Wells talking about how dangerous passion is. And I think this is a problem in leftist activism in general. I mean, it goes to some of the big questions in political theory around, you know, rationality in politics and the role of emotion and questions of what is the meaning of popular action and where does the law fit in the kind of overall political organizing. So, you know, that's why I take on big political theorists like Hannah Arendt, and I wanted to not condemn either side. Because I felt,
when you say either side,
either the anti-lynching movement strategy or the socialist left defense organizing, because they both came out of experiences that informed their politics, right? These were real experiences that people had. The political strategies came from the reality that people were living through. And so if you're facing terroristic mobs, you have to have some strategy for responding to them. And the people in the Haymarket socialist left at that time, the anarchists, actually, to some extent, spoke to those people that were faced with lynching. And their answer, I think, was inadequate. It was, you know, rise up in self-defense, which, if you lived in the post-Reconstruction South, was a completely unrealistic demand to make. Because if you don't have legal protection, you can't just sort of rise up and rebel, right? And Ida B. Wells, in some cases, even says, well, it was very good that people didn't rise up and rebel because they would have been totally crushed. And they acted with rationality and figured out a way to organize in a way that wasn't going to provoke immediate destruction. The idea that, you know, indeed, when people rose up and rebelled, there was serious retaliation. You just have to look at, like, Rosewood, Tulsa, the riots that would be brought against whole communities, and there was no legal recourse. I mean, that kind of terror didn't happen to white activists on the left.
Let me remind our listeners, we're talking to Rebecca Hill, author of this amazing book, Men, Mobs, and Law, and it has chapters such as John Brown, The Left's Great Man, Haymarket, Anti-Lynching and Labor Defense, Communist Party and Defense Tradition, No Wives or Family Encumber Them, Sacco and Vanzetti, goes to Born Guilty, George Jackson, and Return of the Lumpen Hero. So it really covers a lot of the work that either we've been related to or through lawyers who knew the people who were related to, or the American left. And this key, what I thought, a key contradiction about essentially popular uprising and mob violence, or what that represents.
Yeah, Rebecca, I actually knew James P. Cannon. I met him after a civil rights case that I was on in the South in 1969, and he's kind of a direct historical link to what you've been writing about, because he, along with Big Bill Haywood from the IWW, cooked up the idea of the International Labor Defense. And I wanted to say that to preface my question to you. Michael Ratner is the past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Heidi Boghossian is currently executive director. I've been a member since 1965. And we trace our history all the way back to those early days of the communist left and the International Labor Defense that came out of the IWW and the great traditions of mass defense that the IWW brought to the American movement.
IWW being International Workers of the World, of which you've had a current person on here who's organizing against, in favor of IWW unions at Starbucks, Daniel Gross.
Although it's actually Industrial
Gross.
Workers of
the
World.
Industrial. What did I say? International.
International. Yeah, it's a common law.
People always say that. You shouldn't apologize.
Yeah. But industrial, it's right. Just, because of the
IWW,
you know,
the Wobblies. And the Wobblies sought to expose bourgeois justice. Instead of enforcing it like the anti-lynchers that you write about, and they embraced the Bill of Rights, which was a conquest of the American Revolution. I wanted to ask you about what they did in bringing their concepts to the first great case that they fought, which was the Sacco and Vanzetti case, the ILD.
International Labor Defense.
Yes.
Yes. They're international. The International Labor Defense's contribution to the Sacco and Vanzetti case would be the promotion of mass defense organizing to the labor movement, and to try to make the argument that labor organizations should be involved in the defense of individuals, which was really what came out of the Haymarket campaign in the 1880s, right? The idea that the key element of solidarity in a labor union is that when somebody is arrested, when somebody is victimized as a result of organizing, that it's the membership that can save them, not the law, right? That the law is a tool, perhaps, right? That the law can be used as much as it can be, but that it is not enough, and that because the courts are structured by the bourgeoisie, right, by the ruling class, they're stacked against the worker who's in court. They didn't want to have the courtroom take away from the radicalism of the movement, the idea that the courtroom itself should be a political stage where activists had an opportunity to publicize their cause, and that this is something that goes back to the 1880s, really, as a political strategy. And even you could even say earlier, right? There were people who use courts as political platforms,
This is just a great statement, because I think about both the National Lawyers Guild lawyers who became popular, especially defending Black Panthers and the role of in the courtroom and the Panthers. You think of the Center for Constitutional Rights and Bill Kunstler at the Chicago 8 case, and how they basically looked at the courtroom as a platform, the Indian movement certainly out of Wounded Knee, et cetera. So it's great to hear that history.
Well, and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn plays a really important role in the book and in the, you know, in the history of this kind of defense organizing, because she started as kind of a defense expert in the IWW on many Wobbly trials, and then she was very involved in the Sacco and Vanzetti case. Her partner at the time was the leading Italian socialist activist, Carlo Tresca. And so he was the first person that the Italian anarchists went to when Sacco and Vanzetti were first arrested, even though they didn't have the same politics. So that case was really important as actually kind of bridge between the IWW strategy. It was the very earliest years of the Communist Party's existence. And you can see in the 20s that the communist organization, the International Labor Defense, which Cannon was the president of, had taken all the things that, you know, that the IWW defense organizers had been doing all the way through, you know, the 1900s, you know, the 19-teens.
The great free speech fights out on the coast.
The free speech fights, everything, yeah. And their lawyer, Sacco and Vanzetti's lawyer, was a leading lawyer from the IWW who had fought and won very important cases, including a case in New England around strikers who were accused of murder. He had a really good track record. But in the Sacco and Vanzetti case, there was a real tension between the anarchists who were Sacco and Vanzetti's closest comrades, that they were anarchists, that they didn't want to have the kind of organized structure that the International Labor Defense was trying to create. And even before the International Labor Defense was formed, because that happened in 1925, which was right in the middle of Sacco and Vanzetti's defense campaign. They were arrested in 1920, and then they were executed in 1927. For the first 4 years, the labor movement activist lawyer was trying to get mass protests, and every time he would try to sort of publicize the case widely, he would get into a fight with the anarchists on the Sacco and Vanzetti Defense Committee over the strategy, and then eventually they fired him. All the things in this book have been written about just extensively, right? There's a lot of books on Sacco and Vanzetti. There's a lot of books on the Rosenbergs or Scottsboro, but a lot of them don't look at the activist part of it. They're mostly concerned with the legal questions involved or the guilt or innocence. It's something that I don't really deal with at all in the book, is the question of whether people are guilty or innocent. I'm just more interested in how this functions politically. So a lot of the really interesting stuff about the organizing never gets read in archives. So there's this huge correspondence between the lawyer for Sacco and Vanzetti, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, all these activists, the Italian defense committees. No, and it's all, you know, this fascinating stuff about the troubles that they had. And it's really provides a lot of insight into what was it like in the 20s when all these different parties were realigning, because you had fascism developing in Europe, you have a crisis in the socialist movement, you have a rise of Leninism, you have a rise of Stalin, and this is all happening in the context. That's the context for the Sacco and Vanzetti trial and defense, and that's one of the reasons why there was such incredible division among the people. And, you know, historians have blamed communists for trying to use the case or manipulating, but they were one of several different groups that saw this case as important. And, you know, everybody was fighting over it. You know, liberals came in and said, the protests are hurting the case. You know, the protests have to stop because that's what's going to get them killed. You know, the anarchists who they're actually defending are writing letters in Italian that are being published in the Italian press that are suggesting that they that their supporters should bomb the judge's house, you know. So I mean, it's completely, it's very. I guess it's
these
complicated.
These struggles still go on, you know. Even yeah. on our any political case we take, whether it's Guantanamo or otherwise, the struggles among the lawyers, particularly among the lawyers, more than under the activist groups, but among the activist groups somewhat. But the lawyers of whether this we're going to win this in the courtroom or whether we're going to win it in the streets, and not wanting to have protests in front of the Supreme Court, or that's a huge fight that still goes on, and not in the major way you're discussing on Sacco and Vanzetti, but still goes
but
on.
But I think it's something that's been very much, you know, I was very active in the Mumia Abu Jamal defense campaign in the Twin Cities in the from 95 through 2000, and I think that case, I moved to New York right around the time that Leonard Weinglass was fired and the whole controversy around that, you know, defense campaign sort of erupted. And I think that was very much a part of that and very real. And that's part of what, you know, I was informed in writing this and doing the research by my experiences as an activist, too. Right. And so, again, like I try not to be completely you know, sort of polemical on one side or the other, like, oh, the activists are always right or the lawyers are always right, but they have perspectives on this that, you know, they are each, you know, going to bring to defense. I mean, in some cases, lawyers, you know, have a better sense of what's legally going to work. On the other hand, the activists, you know, they, I think that activists have a point in saying that, you know, the law is constraining, right? That focusing so much on the courts is going to cut a lot of people out because they don't feel like they understand what's going on. I don't think you can just sort of throw everything in one basket and say, like, oh, you know, throw out the lawyers and just do popular defense. Or you can't say, you know, just do the legal part and throw out the activists. And it is. It's so difficult. And I think it probably has to be done case by case and thought about strategically. And even within the case, when is a good moment for a really big popular upsurge? When is that going to be counterproductive in a certain way? Although I tend to think that popular upsurge can't be counterproductive.
I'm with you. I was about to say that I generally, in our discussions on our listserv and everything, I'm generally for almost everything that, you know, everything that people can do toward a goal of a popular upsurge,
right,
or toward putting this case in the streets,
right,
or making links with other movements.
Yeah, and the places where you see the greatest successes in the history of labor organizing or any kind of defense organizing, popular defense organizing, it's not based on the legal strategy. It's when is the movement stronger? You see more victories in the 30s because the labor movement was big and consensus was shifting to the left during the New Deal era, and in the 60s. You know, look at the Panther trials, right? You have some trials where there's very, very kind of legalistic approach. Then you have like the Panther 21 trial in New York, right?
I'll never forget that. I was clerking for a judge, Judge Motley, Constance Baker Motley, a wonderful progressive judge. And it was in 1971, I think. And the Panther 21 was going on. And then the jury, after like 9-month trial or whatever, acquitted in 45 minutes on this major trial. But there was a huge popular uprising in the city around that trial.
And their behavior in the courtroom was indecorous, you know, to say the least, right? They were completely saying like they don't respect the procedures. You know, so people have said in the case of Mumia, well, that hurt him and that was why the case went bad. And it, I think what hurt him was that he was tried in the 80s. Was 81, that was after the movement had been, you know, cut off at the knees. So there wasn't the kind of momentum anymore.
Those lessons come out in this book very heavily, I guess.
Oh, thanks.
We're speaking with Rebecca Hill, who's written a really fine book, Men, Mobs, and the Law. It's Anti-Lynching and Labor Defense in U.S. It's a wonderful radical history. It's published by Duke. Again, Men, Mobs, and the Law. We're not going to let you go yet, Rebecca, but I want people to remember the name of this book, Men, Mobs, and the Law, and go get it, because this lays out our experience as radical lawyers and as radicals about what you can do in defense of people who have been victimized by this system.
Can I tell you my favorite funny story from the things? And I put it in the afterword because it was just, I couldn't figure out where else to throw it. I listened to oral history interviews. I read as many things. I read about a lot more cases than I could possibly write about. But one of the most hilarious defense strategies that I encountered was the Bernard Chazanow from the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. And he was describing how he was involved in a strike, and some strikers, I guess, had gotten into a fight with some of the scabs that were supposed to be coming in to the factory to take their jobs, and they were going on trial. And he was a manager, I guess, in the same building, but he was a pro-union manager, and he actually used to have the strike meetings in his house or in his apartment in New York. And he had some kind of inside track, so he knew who was going to be testifying to prosecute the strikers. And his strategy was to take him to the Turkish baths and get him drunk the night before the day of court and, you know, sort of party with him to the point where he wouldn't want to testify the next day. So, you know, there are all kinds of different ways to go about the
any
legal
strategy. Any stick will do to beat a dog.
You know?
You have these perspectives. What happens in the courtroom? What happens on the streets? During that period, how did you look at the John Brown trial in this book?
Brown's case, really, the protest tradition that he's part of is the anti-slavery movement. And there were mass defenses in the anti-slavery movement, although Brown himself didn't ask for one, because he fits in sort of two ways. One is that when I originally started the project, it was about martyrdom and the great martyrs of the left. And John Brown is really the first big left martyr, and everybody goes back to him. So when I chose what to write about, that's kind of where it started. It was, and you know, I had a professor who wanted me to write about John Brown. David Roediger was one of my advisors in graduate school. So that's part of it. But you know, it was turns out that he was a really very informative to kind of understand the defense tradition and the role of race and slavery in as the kind of whole background of where American politics are in kind of shaped, the kind of formative years. So his defense movement is closest to the fugitive slave rescues, which were in fact anti-court room actions, right, where groups of people would actually go into a courtroom and create a bunch of confusion and actually grab somebody and pull them out and spirit them out of town. You know, the most famous case is Shadrach Minkins. Brown wrote advice to people saying, you know, bring small packets of gunpowder into the courtroom and, you know, throw them in the air so that they make a big smoke or explosion. Lewis Hayden was the person that taught him that, and Hayden was the one who did the fugitive rescues in Boston.
Fugitive rescues? I never even knew this. They went into courtrooms and took slaves out.
Yes. Oh. Yeah. So and Oberlin Rescue is another one, John Rice. They got people out. When the people were being taken to court, that's what happened in the Oberlin Rescue. They stopped the stagecoach and get them out and take them to a hotel, and then they get them to Canada. You know, John Brown's sons actually were involved in transporting the Oberlin Rescue people, the actual fugitives, to Canada. And in this case, you have a law that, you know, slavery is legal, that the fugitive slave law is, you know, demands that Northern anti-slavery and abolitionist people support a law that they find contemptible. And so there's no recourse in the legal system at all. I mean, they had defense campaigns when they were tried. All the rescuers who did this were then brought into court, and they just knew that they were going to be, you know, they didn't have legal leg to stand on. That's where you start hearing about higher law, right? People start saying that they're religious activists, so they talk about that they answer to a higher law. The higher law of the Bible, the higher law of God, natural law is what anarchists will talk about later on. That's the kind of strategy that John Brown, too, adopts. I mean, he says, you know, what he did was, you know, according to God's law, not the court in Virginia, that he has no respect for, and that it can't, you know, that he doesn't, the judge isn't a judge, according to him, right? Because his authority is completely based on false, you know, a false law. And that's a very typical kind of heroic defense in a courtroom. And you'll still see people making those kinds of statements. I mean, even people that, you know, I have absolutely no respect for make those kinds of statements. I mean, Milosevic will get up in court and say, I have no respect for this court. It's not legitimate, you know. That's the kind of heroic stance to take in the courtroom, to just completely say, you know, my values are superior to yours. But in the case of the abolitionist movement, and people have used that as a way to sort of say that, okay, John Brown was bad and what he did is dangerous, and that, you know, that in a liberal society with laws, that this is anti-democratic to make these kinds of claims, it leads to terrorism, etc. I think that the fact that Brown was dealing with a law that invalidated the humanity of a significant number of people makes it really hard to sustain the claim that America was a liberal society with a legitimate legal system in the time before the Civil War. I mean, and that's what the abolitionists are saying, right? They're saying, like, how can there be a legitimate law when there's all these human beings that are owned as property? That is the situation. That is why, you know, the people in the American Revolution said that they couldn't legally, through the process of reform, change American society without declaring independence and declaring war on the British government, right? That there's no legitimacy there. There's no recourse in the legal system. And that, you know, is why, you know, abolitionists couldn't say, well, we're just going to reform things from within the system, or, you know, that just wasn't possible.
Yeah, what John Brown did, for our listeners that are not that familiar with the history of it, his notion, and it wasn't a cockeyed notion at all, it might have worked, was that if he liberated the arms out of this arms warehouse, that black slaves would come pick up the arms and free themselves. He's derided in our popular histories as a crazy maniac, But the truth of the matter is he was quite sane, and it was a tactic that he had developed that he courageously undertook with a number of men, including several of his sons, and they almost pulled it off. They might have pulled it off. It wasn't so crazy.
You agree with Michael?
Yeah, I do. And I think, you know, his strategy was to have people he was sort of informed by the Maroons in Jamaica. And also he had people in his army group or his sort of troop. He had formed a troop that had been active with Garibaldi in Italy, studied battlefields in Europe. But the idea was, you know, that he was going to create this kind of army that would go hide in caves and kind of make raids into the plantations so that they – and he had rules set up for these kind of Maroon communities. And also just – there's a great book called Allies that was put together by Gene Libby and a group called Allies for Freedom called John Brown Mysteries. And they have found I went to a conference in Harper's Ferry in 2000 where I heard these folks talk. And, you know, they found – a lot more slaves in Harper's Ferry participated in the raid than has been really put in the historical record.
It's always said that only
like
a
gun,
a dozen or something.
Yeah, a gun that was stolen from a white person in Harper's Ferry during the raid, which was in the attic of a black family in Harper's Ferry.
Oh, my gosh.
And was just recently recovered.
I love it.
There, you know, there were fires set all around. It turns out there were these Quakers who were African-American Quakers who didn't believe in personal violence, but they believed it was okay to do property damage, so they may have been the people who set these fires all around. So, and the people who supported Brown really wanted to emphasize that that there was, in fact, a real constituency of people that would have been involved in the rebellion. John Brown, I don't think of him as a kind of authoritarian figure who's just a religious zealot. I mean, I think he really believed in popular organizing and popular activism, and you can see it in the raid itself and the idea of what you just described, right, that he's going to go and he's going to arm people for their liberation.
One of the great, great heroes in American history. Rebecca Hill, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. You've written Men, Mobs, and Law.
I mean, really the core of radical history in this country.
Thank you so much.
It's really an honor to have you guys say that.
This is what my first defense, when we did the Columbia strikes in 68, 69, and hundreds of people were arrested, the lawyers who started representing us were the National Lawyers Guild lawyers. But the earliest ones of those, the oldest, were like Dave Scribner and others who actually had started and worked with International Labor Defense. And I remember going to their apartments and seeing they had on the walls, I saw the posters from ILD. I mean, so just to read this history for me is fabulous. And it gives you a different perspective on each of these cases than you know, we would have had as lawyers. So it's terrific.
Well, thank you. I mean, coming from you guys,
gosh.
That's a really big, big compliment.
This is really special. So again, it's Men, Mobs, and Law by Rebecca N. Hill, and it's well written. Every sentence is like a gem of intuitive thought, so it's terrific, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Europe's largest oil company, Royal Dutch Shell, faces a lawsuit in a case originally filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights in 1996. U.S. District Court Judge Kimba Wood refused to throw out the case late last month, and the Shell Oil Company faces trial brought by relatives of human rights and environmental activists killed in Nigeria.
The activists were protesting oil production pollution, such as water contamination and agricultural destruction. The lawsuits are brought against the Royal Dutch Petroleum Company, Shell Transport and Trading Company, and very many other defendants. The defendants are charged with complicity in human rights abuses against the Ogoni people in Nigeria. Charges include summary execution, crimes against humanity, torture, inhumane treatment, arbitrary arrest, wrongful death, assault and battery, and the intentional infliction of emotional distress. The trial begins on May 26th of this year. Jenny Green, a lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights, which represents the plaintiffs, said, "Now the public will have the opportunity to see how Shell's complicity with a murderous military regime was its standard operating procedure for doing business in Nigeria." Jenny Green joins us today.
Jenny, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael.
Jenny, I understand that you're one of the trial lawyers in the Wiwa v. Royal Dutch Shell Petroleum case that is going to trial, I guess, soon, right?
Yeah, it's going to trial on May 26th before Chief Judge Kimball Wood in the Southern District of New York here in Manhattan.
Now, I think you filed this case before I get to what it's about. You filed this case probably 12 or 13 years ago, is that right?
November 8th, 1996. So that's filed against the parent corporation.
So if I add 4 plus 9, I get 13. In November, it'll be 13 years. So okay. Give us a little background on the case. What's the case about? What are your expectations?
Well, the case concerns the concerted attacks against people organizing in the Niger Delta against the environmental devastation and human rights violations committed by the partnership of the Nigerian military and Royal Dutch Shell, the Shell Corporation based in The Hague and England. And we sued them for human rights violations against the leadership of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. There was a campaign against Ken Sirawiwa and other leaders who were charging Shell publicly, internationally, and coordinating a very effective movement against Shell, to the tune of 300,000 people peacefully demonstrating against Shell, bringing the claims to the United Nations, developing partnerships with human rights organizations around the world. They were calling attention to the fact that Shell's practices in Nigeria involved constant flaring, the flaring of gas products, creating flaring lasting up to 24 hours a day. Some of the kids in the region have never known dark because of the practice. It's in an area which is based on fishing and farming, and so the pollution of the water supply, the pollution of the land, just devastated people's way of life and ability to support themselves. And when Ken Sirawiwa and MOSUP developed this very effective campaign, the Nigerian military and Shell went after them. And the pattern of the attacks included imprisonment and torture of the leaders.
Now, this was in the 1990s, right, when there was a big mass uprising is what it sounds like.
I mean, what happened was in 1990, there was an Ogoni Declaration of Rights, you know, saying that the environmental practices, the human rights violations were unacceptable. And it was a declaration that said that the companies, which including Shell, which had been present in Nigeria since 1958, could no longer go on exploiting the natural resources of the Delta without some accountability to the Ogoni people. And then in 1991, they took the campaign international.
And what happened that caused you in the mid-90s, 96, to actually file a case, and on whose behalf? You were saying there was a big repressive reaction to the campaign, but can you describe that a little bit more?
Sure. Yeah, the specifics of the campaign included, in 1993, there were two attacks on Ogoni villages. There were actually a series of attacks. So as the peaceful campaign escalated, so did the pattern of repression. And the pattern of repression included the attacks on villagers where a pipeline project was being conducted, and one of our clients was shot, badly wounded, left out in the sun, and ultimately her arm, where she had been shot, became so badly infected that the arm had to be amputated. This is a woman who's a subsistence farmer. You can't do farming without your arm. She lost her left arm. She was left-handed. It just totally debilitated her. In another attack, a young man was shot while he was walking home from the market. The leadership, Ken Sirawiwa and some of our other clients were falsely charged with murder in 1994.
I want to say a word. Ken Saro-Wiwa has been in New York before. He's appeared on radio here. He also is a playwright as well as an environmentalist, or until he was murdered.
Yeah, he had a long history. He also wrote sitcoms in Nigeria. So, but he was a very effective writer, a poet, and really at raising awareness in terms of what was happening and building alliances. He built a lot of alliances here in the United States as well and in Europe. Ken Saro-Wiwa was falsely accused of murdering four other Ogoni leaders. He was in charge with inciting a riot, which led to the killing of these four chiefs, even though he was actually physically prevented by the Nigerian military from being present at the location. There was a sham trial. It was a specially created military tribunal.
We're familiar with those from Guantanamo, but of course, yeah. I guess we copied Nigeria.
Yeah, they may have, right, exactly. Great example of military dictatorship. So the tribunal was created. It was internationally condemned in terms of not meeting any due process standards. Our clients were tortured, mistreated, prevented from access to counsel. Their counsel themselves were harassed. Their relatives were harassed when they came to visit them. Relatives were beaten. And then the lawyers at one point resigned in protest because of the lack of any due process. Then on November 10th, 1995, the nine of the defendants were executed, and they were hung. Including Ken Saro-Wiwa, yeah. And then about a month later, Shell put into place a $4 billion liquefied natural gas project.
So you brought this case subsequent to that, obviously, on behalf of Ken Saro-Wiwa's family. He has a son still living in the United States, or in Canada, I think, right?
His son actually now works in Nigeria. He's an advisor to the president, President Yajua. So he's an advisor on international affairs.
So bring us up to date now. You have the plaintiff suing Shell and some of its subsidiaries, and the trial is scheduled for when?
The trial is scheduled for May 26th. And what we've charged Shell with is complicity in these acts. I mean, they called in the military to subdue the protests. They bribed witnesses at the trial. The head of Shell Nigeria, Brian Anderson, had a meeting with Ken Saro-Wiwa's brother, which basically went along the lines of, if you call off this campaign, maybe there's something we can do about your brother. So he's also a defendant. He came to New York in 2001, ironically, to speak to a conference on business and human rights, and so we sued him.
Well, he spoke to the business part of it, obviously.
Yeah.
Not the human rights part.
what Shell's trying to do around the world, the case continues Saro-Wiwa's activities of trying to expose the double standard that Shell imposes. Shell claims to be this environmentally sensitive corporation, but it has, the classic double standard of what it does in developed areas of the West is very different than the practices that it engages in Nigeria.
Jenny, if people want to learn more about this trial, where can they go?
There's a specific website which we've set up, and it's www.wiwavshell.org, and they can also go to the Center for Constitutional Rights website, ccrjustice.org.
Say them again, Jenny, both the sites.
wiwavshell.org, wiwavshell.org.
Jenny, the trial is for the 26th. Where is it going to be happening, and are you encouraging people to go to the trial?
As I mentioned, the first day is May 26th. We think much of the first day will probably be jury selection, but we will be posting regular updates as to what's happening when on the Wiwa v. Shell website, so people can monitor that website for more information. And we are encouraging as many people as possible to come to, because we think it really sends the message that Shell cannot be conducting its dirty work in private, which is what they've been attempting to do. We were very encouraged last week. There was a ruling by Judge Wood rejecting another motion to dismiss the case by Shell. They were trying to get rid of the majority of our international law claims, and the judge rejected that and said that we could proceed charging Shell with crimes against humanity and the extrajudicial killings of Ken Saro-Wiwa and the others. So we're hopeful that we can do the same at trial.
One aspect I want to bring out, Jenny, these cases of human rights activists represented by the Center for Constitutional Rights, other organizations, are normally, in my mind, David versus Goliath kind of cases, not just because you have a huge corporation and corporate interest on the other side, but of course you have certain law firms on the other side. So in this case, does that sort of fit that paradigm?
It really does. And
who's on the other side?
Cravath, Swain & Moore.
Right, one of our major law firms in New York.
So, they own their own building. which contrasts with our offices. But, it is real discouraging. I mean, because I think in particular for Ken Saro-Wiwa Jr. and, his father, who were trying to figure out a way that there be decent development in Nigeria, they didn't start out thinking that Shell was the enemy. They were trying to reach out to get better business practices, which could actually develop Ogoni in a reasonable way and benefit the people. Ken Saro-Wiwa Jr. has said, I don't believe in retributive justice. I believe in creative justice. But Shell has approached this in a way which is trying to evade all accountability to maximize its impunity. They spent 4 years fighting us over whether they could even be tried here in New York. And they just continue to issue statements talking about the tragedy and the mistakes of the past, which is just an insult to, people were killed. Leaders were hung for peaceful protests. That's not just a mistake. Yeah, it's a David and Goliath battle, but it's one that we have to fight because it doesn't seem that there's any willingness to acknowledge and be accountable for their role. These human rights violations, it's not mistakes, it's not tragedies, it's human rights violations that they participated in. Where we are is they need a judge to, a jury to tell them so, then that's where we are.
I'll sort of last question on this because I know that I've followed your work on these in this area closely as I'm at the center, that this is at least the second case that you've been involved with on what I would call extractive industries, but particularly the oil industry. And there was the Unocal case, which that was the Burma pipeline, which you were able to settle on the eve of trial. There's this one, and are there others? Is there a reason you think oil companies are always at least not always, but often at the end of our litigation?
Unfortunately, there are cases also against other forms of industry. There were cases against clothing manufacturers in Saipan,
sweatshop cases.
Yeah, the sweatshop cases, and that case also successfully settled. There was a case against Yahoo for complicity in suppression of dissent in China, which also successfully settled this past year.
Oh, and you had your South Africa apartheid cases as well,
the
right?
South Africa apartheid cases. Those cases have just there's been a major victory in saying that corporations can be held liable for aiding and abetting. And that case is back before a trial court and is going into discovery after surviving motions to dismiss. Unfortunately, it's not even limited to one particular industry. We're hopeful that if we can be successful in this trial, if we can continue the pattern of successes, and I include the settlements there in that category, that we can build the momentum for establishing standards so that corporations cannot commit the conduct in the first place. But right now, we really do seem to be at the stage, though, where there has to be kind of the stick of the threat of punishment, and the main punishment right now is civil litigation. So, we're hoping that eventually that we will have an effect on actually changing corporate behavior.
Well, Jenny, thank you. I know you have, I guess, they use the expression the patience of Job, but I'm not sure that's a good expression. but in any case, I know this one's 13 years, and each one is major and huge, and huge amount of time as well as resources. So thank you for your work and good luck in May.
Thank you very much.
We'd like to take a few minutes now to thank our affiliate stations around the country.
You know, we broadcast out of studios on Wall Street in New York City to the tri-state area on this tremendously powerful transmitter. But we've got 19 other stations that carry our program from coast to coast and even in Alaska. And we wanted to mention them and thank all our listeners out there.
Well, we have WHYS, which is Eau Claire Community Radio 96.3 FM in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. KRFP Radio Free Moscow 92.5 FM, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee. Radio Free Nashville 98.9 FM.
And we also have KSOW in Cottage Grove, Oregon 106.7 FM. WYAP in Clay, West Virginia 101.7 FM. And KRFC 88.9 FM in Fort Collins, Colorado.
WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. We also have WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton, Massachusetts.
And KEIF FM at 104.7 in Enid, Oklahoma. And Fort Royal, Virginia is broadcasting our show at 1640 AM. And also in Asheville, North Carolina, WPVM, that's 103.5 FM.
ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago, Auckland, Atlanta, Boston, and Melbourne. Also, Moton Community House Radio, which is online, and WLRI in Gap, Pennsylvania.
And we have WPRR at 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS in Columbus, Ohio, which is a community radio station broadcasting to Central Ohio. And KKFI 90.1 FM in Kansas City, Missouri.
We have Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thank you for joining us, Free Radio Santa Cruz. That's our newest edition. And of course, as always, our local station WBAI New York City 99.5 FM.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.